All right, so today we are diving into a new book in the Bible, the book of Galatians. There's only 10 verses. This is quite different from our the sermons that came before, which typically covers the whole chapter. Now, only 10 verses, so we're going to go slow, and we will take a look at different words. So if you could have the Bible right in front of you, that would be helpful. So this is the letter Paul wrote to the churches in Galatia. And those churches, historically speaking, most likely, those are the churches that we just met in our Acts sermon series. So if you've been here the past few weeks, you would have been familiar with these cities and their churches. Remember Antioch of Pisidia, right? The city high in the mountain where many retired Roman officials lived, that Antioch. And Iconium, another city where Jews and Gentiles kind of lived in peace for a while. And then Lystra, remember that city? The Zeus worshipers, right? And then Derbe, we didn't know much about it. Paul was only here for a short while. So these churches were the churches of Galatia. Okay, so those are the churches that Paul wrote this letter to, and we just learned about their story. Now, what we've been trying to do in these past few months is to study the early history of the church so that we know their story, so that we can learn from their examples to know how we ought to move this storyline forward. And because we have the same mission as they did, if we could learn how they operated, how God used them, we could gain wisdom to know how we ought to live in our current context. So what we're doing is that we're using the book of Acts as the narrative backbone, and now we've just learned about how those churches got established, and now we're slowing down to take a look at one of their letters, to take a peek at what they're talking about, to help us immerse in their stories even more, so that we could understand their story a little better. So let's open the envelope and take a peek at their letter. So this is their letter writing etiquette back in the days. They would start out by identifying who the author is. So that's why you see in verse 1, Paul says, I'm the author, I'm Paul, an apostle, but not just me. Verse 2 says, I am writing with all the brothers who are with me. Okay, and then after identifying the author, they will quickly identify the recipient of the letter, which are the churches in Galatia, again in verse 2. That's how they would start a letter. And after that, they would have a section for greetings. If you're writing to your boss, this would be the place to flatter him. If you're writing to your subordinates, this is the place where you tell them how proud you are of them. Right. Now, in Paul's letters, he follows this typical letter writing structure, and he would use this section to pronounce blessings. Now, if you could see in verse 3, he pronounced blessings with the grace and peace of God to the churches. So he's kind of following that same format. But typically, after blessings, he would give thanks to God. He would thank God for how well the churches are doing. And this is essentially him saying that how proud he is of the churches that he's writing to. So for example, in his letter to the Ephesians, after the blessings, he would say, oh, I heard about your faith in the Lord Jesus and your love toward all the saints. I do not cease to give thanks to you. So basically saying, good job, keep it up, so proud of you. Again, another letter to the Thessalonians, he's like, after the blessings, he says, we give thanks to God always for all of you, remembering before our God the Father your work of faith and labor of love. Again, great job, keep it up, proud of you. That's what happens after blessings, typically. But here in Galatians, blessings is in verse 3, and then after the blessing, we come to verse 6. No thanksgiving. Straight to the point. What does he say? He's like, I'm so astonished that you're so quickly deserting God. He's not like, oh, great job having faith, good love, and work and all that. Wonderful. He's like, I'm astonished by your lack of faith and your rejection of God himself. I'm shocked and I'm so disappointed in you. So this definitely does not qualify as pleasantry, right? This is quite unpleasant, quite explosive. So what did the Galatians do to deserve this kind of harsh letter? Right? What happened in those cities that Paul had to write this letter? Do you see anything in here? Like, what did they do? Do you see anything in these verses? Toward the end of verse 6, do you see that? They are turning to a different gospel. Are you see that? They are turning to a different gospel. And verse 7, he's like, well, it's not like there's another one. There's only one gospel that could truly save. But somebody came in and distorted the gospel, so that you're following those teachers and betraying God. Now, remember last week we talked about that churches would face two different levels of problems or conflicts, right? And we use the analogy of a tree. If it's concerning the core message of the gospel, it's like the root of the tree. And with that kind of problems, we need clear-cut answers, and it needs to be sturdy. But if it's concerning missional strategies, that's like the shoots or the branches of the tree. And with those, we have much flexibility, right? Remember that. And here, it's talking about root level problem. They're turning to a different gospel. Now, with this kind of issue, eternal lives are at stake. So Paul is turning up the heat, and he's definitely not trying to please people or seeking approval from people by writing this letter. So he's preventing people from betraying God and falling off the only gospel that can truly save. So that's what this letter is about. Now, for us modern Christians, I don't know about you, but there is a common situation for many Christians, is that sometimes we may wonder, like, are we really believing in the right gospel? Is the gospel message that we are being fed the true one? Could it be that there's something out there, something else that we didn't know about, things that are required for our salvation that we never learned about? Right. What if I'm believing in the wrong thing? And at the end of my life, I got toasted. It was like, I didn't even know about that. Could that happen? Now, this kind of anxiety is normal and it's common among Christians. And throughout the ages, this has been a point of anxiety for many Christians. And false teachings tend to sneak into churches by leveraging this kind of anxiety. False teachers would tend to teach you something that, oh, there's a secret knowledge that you didn't have, but those things are actually required for your salvation. And people will latch onto it to feel a little safer. But in reality, that kind of teaching pulls people away from the real gospel message. But then the question is, how do we tell? Right? How do we know what's true teaching and what's false teaching? That's part of what this letter is about, okay? So let's keep this big question in mind, and we'll keep coming back to this question. Right? How do we know? How do we tell which gospel is correct? Now, to help us understand this letter, we first need to establish the theological framework around this letter. Now, when I say theological framework, it might sound fancy. It's really not, right? If you think of this letter as a story, then the theological framework is really the setting of the story. Just some background knowledge that you need to know in order to understand this letter. Just to know what kind of structure that Paul has set up so that he's doing all the maneuvers within that structure and it's so that you could follow Paul's argument. So, today I'm going to spend most of our time on establishing that structure, and we're going to use that framework in future weeks as we go into this letter. So, you might be wondering, like, where do we get that framework? Where do we get the theological settings that he's operating in? Now, have you noticed in Paul's letter openings, he tends to pack in a lot of dense theological statements in his greetings, in his self-identification, right? What I mean by this is, see verse 1, Paul an apostle, and then he just had to put in that sentence, right? Not from men nor through men, but through Jesus Christ and all that, right? And verses 4 and 5, all those things are add-ons. Those are part of the greetings. Why did he need to pack in all those dense theological statements? Now, growing up, I always thought that this is how Christians talk. Right? Just always needing to add in more spiritual sounding stuff to sound spiritual, right? Now, what Paul is actually doing is that by throwing in those theological terms, he is reminding his readers of the theologies that they've learned so that they know what Paul is going to talk about. So his expectations would have been that when the readers see those theological terms, they would have a mental picture of Paul's theological framework. So what would be helpful for us to do is to pay a little bit more attention on those theological terms so that we know what Paul wants us to have in mind as we read his letters. Okay. So today I'm going to pick out those elements and I will construct a story background in our minds to prepare for future sermons, okay? Now, we're gonna start with verse 4. Verse 4. Do you see the phrase, the present evil age? The present evil age. You see that? Okay, I am going to use some illustrations powered by Google Slides, right? Very, very rudimentary, but helpful. Now, the present evil age. So when people see the present evil age, they would already have this mental picture in mind. So here's how the story began, right? God created a peaceful world for his glory, but humans sinned, and that sin turned the whole world evil. Sin messed up the whole world so that there's no more peace in the world, only chaos, confusion, decay, and eventually it will end up dead. That's how the present evil age will end. So this is the present evil age sinners were trapped in. The sinners were trapped in this sinful evil age by their sin. So the ship is going down and people will die with it. That's the present evil age. Okay, but then God the Father did not want this to happen. God the Father did not want this to happen. Do you see the phrase, the will of God the Father? I think it's in verse 4. The will of our God and Father, at the end of verse 4. So, what is the will of our God and Father? His will is not that that people will die with this present evil age. His will is to deliver them from this present evil age, right? You see that in verse 4? Okay, so this is his will. His will is to somehow deliver people from this present evil age so that this world just doesn't end up dead. So how is he going to do that? How is he going to deliver people from this present evil age? Well, his will, earlier in verse 4, says his will would be to have the Son Jesus Christ, to give himself up for the sins of the people. Do you see that earlier in verse 4 and then in verse 3? Okay, so I'm going to trace it here. The will of the Father is for the Son to enter into the world and to die for the sins of his people. And with that death on the cross, he paid for the sin of the people. So loosening that chain that chained people into this present evil age so that they could be delivered from this present evil age. Okay, so that's the mental picture that this verse is drawing. Okay, so they were delivered from this present evil age to where? To where? Now, if you have the present evil age, that means you will have a future good age. an age that is not dying, an age that is everlasting, an age that is not dark, but bright. So, in Christian theology, this everlasting, bright future age, that age was inaugurated and kicked off by the resurrection of Jesus. Okay, so that's a key moment in Christian theology. This new age is kicked off by Jesus' resurrection. That's why in verse 1, Paul mentioned Jesus' resurrection early on. Do you see that? God the Father who raised him from the dead in verse 1. So Jesus became the first human being to receive that kind of life that belongs to that future age of peace. So he essentially kicked open the door to that future age with his resurrection. And he did it so that others could follow him into that new age. And this essentially is the Christian gospel message. Now, I'm going to locate where the gospel is. The gospel is over here. That's the point of the gospel. Because now the gospel, the word gospel means good news, right? I think we have heard that. The gospel literally means good news. But it's not just any kind of good news. It's specifically the kind of good news that's concerning in the beginning of a new age, the beginning of a new kingdom, okay? It's a kind of news that says, oh, a new king defeated an old king, and that new king established a new kingdom. That's what gospel means. So the Christian gospel message is that Jesus came into this dark world, and he defeated the old king of sin to loosen his bond over people so that they could enter into this new kingdom that Jesus started with his resurrection. That's what Christian gospel is. Now, this is great news for people, but then how do people benefit from this good news if they never learned about this? All right, so people need to hear about this for them to even benefit from it. So the gospel message needs to get to them somehow. So how could the gospel message get to people? Now in verse 6, do you see the word call? Called. Now, the word call means that people don't hear the gospel message by actively searching for it. Okay? People don't actively search for it so that they could receive the message. No. God took the initiative to call them from heaven. God took the initiative to call them from heaven. And that act of calling from heaven is described by the word grace. That act of calling from heaven is described by the word grace. If you've heard of the word grace means free gift. Right? It means that you didn't earn it. It's not like you worked for it and you earned it. No, God just sent that gift to you from heaven without you doing anything. That's a gift. So that call from God to you, that is a gracious call. That is grace. And for that message to get to you, how does that grace flow to people? Well, God sent his messengers to get that message to you. And that whole act is God giving you a gift. And the earliest people that God used to send that message are called the apostles. The apostles. So that in verse 1, Paul says, I am that apostle to you. God put me in charge as his apostles to send that gift to you. I was not appointed by man, I was appointed by God. And my job would be to send you that gift of the gospel message so that you could benefit from Jesus did for you so that you could be delivered from this sinking ship and enter into that everlasting life. Okay? This is the framework that people would have had in mind as they read through this letter opening. Now, this whole thing was the will of God the Father. And when this whole thing worked as planned, you will notice that the world got restored to its original purpose, which was to glorify God the Father. Okay? Which is to glorify God the Father. When everything works well, God the Father would be glorified. That's the end point of this whole story. I'm done, okay? The framework is here. I'm done, okay? You still with me? Now, we're going to keep coming back to this in the following weeks, hopefully not as boring, because we're going to use this to look at false teachings and Christian living and all that. Now, when all these things worked as planned, God gets the glory. But right now, Paul is saying, you Galatians, you're following another gospel. Okay. You're following some teachings that did not cohere with the gospel message that you received. And you're turning away from the gospel that could truly save. And you're not just betraying me as your gospel. You're deserting God. You're deserting the God who called you. You're rejecting God's gift. And that's a slap on God's face. And that's eternally dangerous. So this was a serious issue. And Paul was clearly worked up about this because he deeply cared about the churches. Now, but let's be a little less critical of them, right? I just step back and ask, like, how were they supposed to know? How were the Galatians supposed to know which one is the right gospel? I mean, we all learn things from different teachers, right? And teachers would teach different things. How could we tell which teacher we ought to trust? Just whoever has the higher academic credentials or whoever talks better? Whoever could perform better miracles, right? Who do we trust? That's the question that we must ask. And here's something interesting in verse 8. Paul is trying to answer that question in verse 8. And verse 8 is really weird and interesting. In verse 8, Paul says, what do you trust? What do you trust? Seems like he's teaching people that, hey, you must trust the gospel message I told you before. Trust the gospel message I told you before. Trust that message rather than anybody. Okay, not even me. He included himself into the people that they're not supposed to trust. So that's kind of weird. All right, so Paul is like, even if I come back and tell you something different, don't trust me. Even if angelic beings come to you and they perform otherworldly things, don't trust them if they preach something different from the earlier message. So that's kind of weird, right? But let's notice that in his framework, it is not the messenger that validates the message. It's the other way around. It's the message that validates the messenger. The authority is somehow in the message, not in the messenger. So Paul's apostleship is valid only insofar as he's preaching that message. If he's not preaching that message, that earlier message, then his apostleship is nullified. So this is a key principle, okay? The authority is not tied to the messenger, but to the message. But you could rightly ask, like, how does that work? How does that work? What made the earlier message so authoritative? What made it authoritative in the first place? That's kind of weird, right? Now, I'm going to give you the answer right away, and we're going to sit with it for the remainder of this letter. Okay. Now, the thing that validated the earlier message was the resurrection of Jesus. Okay, that's the answer. It was the resurrection of Jesus that validated the message. So look at verse 1. That's why Paul puts it there. His apostleship was dependent on the resurrection of Jesus. As long as he was preaching the resurrection of Jesus, his apostleship was valid. So I know this might sound odd, but resurrection is put forth as the backstop of the chain of authority. And the reason why resurrection could be put there as the backstop of the chain of authority is that God was behind it. God was behind it. God was behind the resurrection. So you see, the death and resurrection of Jesus was God speaking definitively to the world. He was proclaiming to the world through the death and resurrection of Jesus that the power of sin has been defeated and the new age of eternal life has begun. God was shouting to the world through that event of Jesus' death and resurrection. He's telling people, now the salvation is available to you through Jesus. So that's the final and capstone speech of God to the world for their salvation. So nothing can or should be added to that. Okay, so that's the central point of Christianity. So back to our big question. Like, how do we know if we have the right gospel message? Who do we trust? Well, we trace that chain of authority back to God himself. And he spoke directly to us through the death and resurrection of Jesus. So we can trust any teaching or teacher who puts the death and resurrection of Jesus front and center in their message. That's the validation we can have in terms of the trustworthiness of the message. So if anyone, including Paul, including any angels, who preaches anything that adds to or bypass Jesus' death and resurrection, they are to be cursed, because that's not the message that saves. Again, God is behind the resurrection, so the message should put the resurrection front and center in its rationale. And because God is behind it, if any angels who comes in to teach anything else, don't trust it. Angels are not bigger than God. That's the reasoning. Okay, so beyond the content of the teaching, we can also observe the shape of death and resurrection in the messengers. Okay? You see, God demonstrated his power to save through the resurrection of Jesus. And he intends to use that power of resurrection to save people. And in the message of the gospel, it carries the power of resurrection. Because that power needs to flow through the message to the people to save them, right? Now, so that message carries the power of resurrection. So any messengers who receives that message and preaches that message, the power of resurrection will flow in and through them. So they would receive an imprint of Jesus' death and resurrection in their lives. So think about Paul. When he was going through the cities in Galatia, did he not display death and resurrection of Jesus? Right? He was literally stoned to death, or almost dead, and he just popped back up miraculously. That was Jesus clearly speaking through him. But more than that, remember he showed tremendous courage by going back to those cities? Right? The kind of courage that only belongs to the age to come. And that was also a proof or a mark of resurrection in his life. So all that is to say, the real gospel was accomplished by the death and resurrection of Jesus. So any message or messengers who carries the mark of Jesus' death and resurrection, they are the true ones. That's how we recognize the true gospel. So that's the main point I want to make today, and this is groundwork And next week, we will take this idea and apply it to different things. So there's a lot more to talk about with this idea, and we'll save that for later sermons. For now, let's once again remember to have the death and resurrection of Jesus at the front and center of our hope for our salvation. Let us not trust in our skills, our might, our money, our knowledge, or anything in me or anything in this world for our salvation. Rather, our trust should completely be in Jesus and what he did for me on the cross and in that tomb. So let's once again express that simple faith by receiving communion together. Now we're taking communion together today. If you didn't get the elements, you could get it in the back. Now the act of taking communion, it is a posture of receiving. Right? It is receiving what we didn't earn. It's receiving a free gift from heaven, knowing that God's call coming to us is purely grace. We didn't do anything to earn it. And we want it, we know it gives us life, so we take it in. And we not only express it by our mouth, by our statement, but we express it by receiving and drinking and eating. And Jesus instituted this rite or this ritual for us to embrace it with our body. So let's do this now. On the day that Jesus was betrayed, he took bread and says, "This is the body broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me." So let's remember Jesus died for us so that we can have life. Let's receive that grace. And in the same way, after supper, he took the cup and says, "This is the cup of the new covenant. This is my blood shed for you." This is Jesus dying for our sins to lose the bond of sin so that we can be delivered from this present evil age. Let's drink it to receive this grace. Now let's stand and let's confess what we're confessing by taking the bread and drinking the cup.